Hello, a very warm welcome to episode 6 of Gita Decoded. Sister Denise has been sharing her wisdom and insight into the all-important chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna addresses Arjuna for the first time, gives him courage, gives him wisdom, and also shares with him the deep secrets of things like the story of immortality, reincarnation, etc. We've just started chapter 2, and so we're continuing with it because we were not able to go through the entire chapter in one episode. So Sister Denise, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I think we are now on plus minus page 31 of my translation. So the message that Arjuna receives is that which he considers to be a sin, in other words, to kill, to destroy, is actually indestructible. So this is the message that he's already received. And Sister Denise, why is it we regard that which is immortal as mortal? What is it in the human psyche that takes things at face value? Why is the truth not obvious to us? Why do we need God to tell us this?
There are two reasons. One of them is that the soul has lost power to such an extent that the natural ability to be aware of the self as a soul is gone. And what happens when that leaves is that you become conscious of yourself as a material object. You identify with your body, you become what we call as body conscious, and then whatever you perceive through your five senses, you say that is real, which means the first thing is your own body, the second thing is other people's bodies, and the third thing is other physical realities, cultural surroundings, and so on. The second thing is that people have forgotten. One is in a state of forgetfulness, and so you're kind of, in a way, groping in the dark. And so whatever you can feel, you say, that's what it is, and you interpret it with insufficient capacity to perceive. And so the spiritual consciousness is an awakened awareness where you can perceive something over and above its physical form. You can see the thing which is real, which is the being, and you're not deluded by the physical aspect.
I find the wording on page 31 very interesting, where it is said that the highest calling for a warrior is what is called righteous battle. Okay, what is righteous battle? And Sister Denise, on page 31, the reader is introduced for the first time to caste duty. What does caste duty mean? There are a number of people watching you who have no knowledge or experience of Indian culture and, well, the caste system that exists in this country. So what is caste duty?
Well, let's just look at one question at a time here.
Okay.
Because the first thing is the just war. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the political environment that we're in at the present time in the 21st century, you will see that there are different military powers who seek to justify military activity as the pursuit of a just war. And so there are various criteria for a just war. And I think this goes back to this idea of the highest duty of a warrior is to fight where war is required. If you look at the Hagakure, which is the scripture for the Japanese samurai, there you have a lot of description of what the warrior has to be doing. And the warrior, if you look at the human society, and then you're asking about the caste duty, which is absolutely connected, of course. The traditional castes are the Brahmins, who are the priest caste, and then you have the warriors, who are the rulers, Then you have the business community, the Vaish, and then you have the lowest caste, the peasants, the workers, the Shudras, and then you have all sorts of subcastes in between. So traditional society is like that. And traditional society carried on more or less undisturbed until about the 18th century, where the Industrial Revolution occurred in, the 19th century, the 1830s in Europe, where science began. And then conventional science was really formulated, say, in the 1920s. Then you have new science, which is formulated around the 1970s, all of which took place, the First World War, the Second World War, everything changed, and the traditional society disappeared. Now, in India, there is still traditional society in the agricultural areas, but more and more there's urbanization. And as soon as you come into the urban world, you're dealing with industrial developments, and there's a change in the whole arrangement of the politics. You have Gandhi, who raised the idea of we should outlaw untouchability, we should emancipate women. All of these modern political ideas are very much in opposition to traditional society, whereas the kind of the religious spiritual component is very, very fixed in traditional society and is trying to bring that onto the modern world, which doesn't work very well at all. And it ends up being, in a way, tremendously in opposition to what we call human rights. So there's a big problem, and this is where you have this description of the destruction of Dharma. So, Dharma, in one sense, can refer to the age-old traditional system where everything works nicely as long as the human population is really small, as long as there's plenty of agricultural land, and so on and so on. But as time went on, all of this stopped happening. So a person lost their identity in that, because in the society of India, you cannot shift your caste. Whatever caste you're born into, that's that. And you will do what your father did before, and you will follow, and no ifs, ands, or buts is not possible. So then people grapple with this, and when you're looking at the Gita as a modern day relevant piece of advice or literature, in a way, Srimat means the highest advice, how to be a good quality human being. Then in that case, we will not look at caste as what you're born into, but there's another interpretation of caste, which is what caliber of human being are you in terms of quality? And that especially in terms of how you relate to God, how you relate to the principles and ideals of spirituality. So for example, a Brahmin by caste is one thing. They may or may not follow the ideals of what it means to be a Brahmin, but when you interpret it according to karma, if a person is performing karma of highest purity, then that would be a Brahmin type of person, very sattvic, very pure behavior, pure lifestyle. Purity is the main characteristic of a Brahmin, and their relationship with God is completely in tune with, in alignment with, and absolutely following the footsteps of Brahma, you see. And Brahma is, in that sense, the instrument of creation. Usually Brahma is considered as part of the Trinity, Brahma, Vishnu, Shankar, or Mahesh, or Shiva. And again, there's a mixing of the incorporeal with the bodiless. Of course, incorporeal and bodiless mean the same thing. But if you look at the Trinity as the first creation of the Creator, then Brahma means the instrument for creation, Vishnu the instrument for sustenance, and Shankar the instrument for destruction. So this then referring to the acts of God. And so according to Brahma Kumari's knowledge, Brahma is a person who is taught by God how to be an ideal human being, because creation is done through that. Creation, I go back to a phrase that I had mentioned earlier, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, but what did God say? And basically, what God says is, follow a life of purity, perform pure karma, because this is what is going to create a new world, a new cycle, a new civilization. And then Vishnu is the four-armed image, the perfected male and female, the couple, which is the ideal foundation of the sustained society of a future civilization. And then you see Shankar naked, referring to the state of becoming free from the delusions of identification with the body. You see, because the body means sense perception. Body consciousness means that you take the information through sense perception to be reality. So if you are a kshatriya, the warrior, you are constantly battling between what you know to be a better quality of life and then the power of sense perception to pull you away from actually following that. So that would be the warrior person who's constantly battling internally and striving but unsuccessfully. And then the merchant becomes the one who's constantly making deals, you know, with God. But look, you know, if I do just this much for you, then you can sort of, you know, look after the shortfall in my spiritual effort. And of course, it doesn't work like that. But that's the next level down. And then the lowest level, the Shudra, means a person who is totally unable to be anything other than totally hedonistic and absolutely under the thrall or enthralled to the sense perceptions and doing negative karma all the time. So then your caste duty becomes something more like, well, what kind of person am I aspiring to be? And of course, what we would say in Brahma Kumaris is, well, the best kind is the Brahmin. And so strive to be a good quality Brahmin, but bear in mind that there is some battling involved, so there'll be a little bit of kshatriya along the way. And beware of trying to do too much bargaining, because you're going to get distracted from the right thing. And bear in mind also that your personal weaknesses can get the better of you, and you have to be very vigilant and try all the time to absorb spiritual power through your meditation from the incorporeal Supreme Being, because this is going to enable you to rise above the lower chakras, the lower energies that pull you into negative emotions and inability to control your feelings. So we would interpret it a little bit more like that.
Mr. Denise, has caste anything to do with the body?
In terms of how people have interpreted it, it depends on your birth, you see. And so depending on what family you got born in, it is assumed that you're born into a family according to your karma of your previous birth. So if you're born into a lower caste, it's considered that, well, you did bad karma and that's why. And so you have to just deal with that. And if you're born in a high caste, then that means you must have done some good karma, so that's your reward. And so it's interpreted in a very bodily way. But at this time, we would say that that's not the best way to work with caste. It's rather better to look at caste in terms of what kind of karma, what standards of lifestyle do you live by? What principles do you live by? And that will indicate what quality of person you are and what caste you are in that sense.
Your answer was long, but very, very thought-provoking, I must say.
Thank you.
Mr. Denise, the next part of the conversation that ensues between God and Arjuna is God issuing a very clear warning as to the consequences of Arjuna not taking up the battle. The words are, thereupon, having avoided your own duty and glory, you shall incur evil. Okay? And he goes on to say that you will lose your honor, and this is a disgrace that is worse than dying. That is a bitter pill to swallow. And if one is invested in Arjuna, in other words, where you start identifying with Arjuna, you think, you feel it.
Sure.
Okay, so take us through that.
Well, you know, there are three kinds of sins.
There is?
One is a sin of commission, where you do the wrong thing. The second one, which I think is being raised in this phrase that you're mentioning here, the sins of omission, you see. When a person doesn't do what they should do, certainly they will incur evil and they will incur sin and they will have to pay for that. You see, but many people, they don't really realize that avoiding what you have to do brings on the energy of sin. The third kind, which is something I think is only really talked about in Brahma Kumaris and not elsewhere, but I still think it's very interesting to consider it, and that is that when you take sorrow from some negative thing that someone has done to you, there also you incur sin. Because the highest way of action is to be able to endure and become neutral when somebody sins against you, you know. So, and if you take it on, it contaminates your soul and thereby becomes another kind of sin. So this warning that God is giving...
Pause. Describe the last part again. If you're harmed in any way and you accept the sorrow of that, then what happens?
You know, somebody does something against you, what it very often will provoke in you is vindictiveness, the urge to take revenge. You will go over it again and again and again. There'll be resentment and so on. And this way of taking that poison in poisons you more. And it actually has the same effect as if you had done something wrong to somebody. But that means it becomes a sin because you're contaminating the purity of yourself through your resentment, your vindictiveness, your desire to take revenge. It's not clean. And this is why the yogi has to have powers and power of endurance, power of accommodation, make it possible for you to maintain your purity even in the face of someone trying to contaminate you. That is something that people don't really think about much, but in the practice of Raj Yoga that I do with Brahma Kumaris is very important, because if you don't realize that you're contaminating yourself, you'll be confused as to how come you're not progressing. That's because you're doing that third type of sin.
I'm sorry, I'm still recovering from the shock of what you just said. Okay, so, Mr. Denise, the standards that have been laid down in the Bhagavad Gita and explained by you are incredibly, incredibly high. Is it within the purview of the viewer, I don't want to say average viewer, to achieve what you just said? You are speaking about somebody who's in the receiving end of punishment from life, and what is expected of the person in order not to perpetuate the sin, the karma, is to not take sorrow despite the fact that it's given to you. We're talking about physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain, psychological pain. So you said it's coming to you, it's hit you, it knocked on your, it didn't knock on your door, it broke down your door, entered your home, contaminated you, got to you, and you what? Don't feel it. Is this possible?
It is possible.
By whom?
If you want to take maximum advantage, suppose there you are, you're a just basic person, and God comes knocking on your door and says, would you be interested in studying with me? Because if you do, I can teach you things that nobody knows. And through that, you can become a most extraordinary person. So you could say, well, that sounds pretty interesting to me, what's involved? And then you gradually start to discover some of these things. But when you have the direct communion with the Supreme Being, soul to Supreme Soul, you take energy, you take power. And it's a lifetime process, no doubt. But what you experience, if you decide to do that, is that these things, from being a totally impossible ideal, they become progressively doable. And it's progressive, because what you find when you do this is that you fail a lot of the time. But every time you fail, you get an opportunity to assess where you're weak, where you have insufficiently absorbed spiritual power, and you gradually start to actually become able to manifest those capabilities. So this we speak about in Brahma Kumaris as the cultivation, the development of virtues and powers. And then from being an ordinary person, you slowly become less and less ordinary, more and more extraordinary, and you experience within yourself that there is a sustainable change going on. Of course, it takes time. Is slow, but is real and is lasting, and so it is so desirable.
Yeah, desirable. That's not the adjective that comes to mind right now, but we'll stick to desirable.
All right.
Okay. So, Sister Denise, God first gives Arjuna his company, and then he gives him courage, and then wisdom. Is there a significance to that order?
Well, Arjuna is like any of us. We are just people, and yet destiny has brought us to a point in time where there is this encounter between the soul in his completely ordinary condition and God, the Supreme Soul, and this combination, this, you can say, fusion of the two is an extraordinary opportunity in which you can become godlike. And this is why sometimes you can say this is the creative time. This is what the Gita is about. The Gita is about God taking a you know, person who is fine, upright human being, but not strong enough to actually live that way under any circumstances. And God will, you know, give you the teaching, give you the power, and actually make it possible for you to transcend your normal limitations. And I think this is the speciality of God. This cannot be done by a human being. But when a human being comes into connection and relationship with the Supreme Being, something happens which is most extraordinary. And I think that in so many ways, what people would like, the quest, what it is to find that, you know. When people speak of the Holy Grail, the quest for the Grail, the way I look at it, this is it. This is the Holy Grail that you drink from. You drink from this fountain of knowledge and nectar of immortality. There's so many expressions that you find across the different cultures which actually refer to this absorption in the human soul of what is within God, so that you transcend your limitations and you become something divine.
Okay, Sister Denise, on page 39, the reader is introduced for the first time to the law of karma. And I find it interesting that it's brought in at this juncture. And the words are, now hear it as it is applied in arduous practice, yoke with this determination, Arjuna, you shall rid yourself of the bondage of karma. It comes immediately after the warning of what will happen to you and how you will lose your honor if you don't take up this fight. And the bondage of karma, that's very visual in the way it's expressed, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Well, you see, I think the operative word is arduous practice.
Ah, okay.
It's really God saying to you, look, if you want to achieve what's achievable, you have to do it seriously. I compare it with somebody who decides to take up music or dance professionally, and they will go to a guru who will expect absolute obedience and surrender so that that teacher can actually make that person into a highly skilled performer.
A virtuoso.
So there you have to think about it. Do I want to do this at this level? And so you have to stop and think, you know, well, what is my capacity? Well, I don't know. And so God is saying, look, I know your capacity better than you. If I'm offering this to you, it means you have a chance. So have full faith in yourself that since I'm God and I'm wanting to carry you forward at this level, you can take the risk to say, yes, let me give it a go. But then you have to be willing to go for the long haul, and you have to be willing to engage in pretty arduous disciplines with the understanding that God will take you to that level. So you have to really sit down with yourself and think, do you want to do this? Do you want this? And it's really a question of what do you want for yourself? And if you really want this, you can have it. If you don't really want it, don't really care, you want to do things at a simple level, well, that's good too. But it's like a step comes where God is saying, okay, we've reached this far. Now, do you want to go for the PhD, or are you happy with just the bachelor's? You know, it's a little bit like that.
Okay, unfortunately, we have to stop there. But Sister Denise, this subject of the bondage of karma is so riveting. I think it's necessary to take it up at the beginning of the next episode. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the end of this episode. Sister Denise has shared some extremely deep aspects to spirituality, I think, which most of us have not considered before. I mean, I was quite shocked to hear that if you take on sorrow that's inflicted upon you by life, someone or something, and if you get hurt by it emotionally, then you are perpetuating your karmic account. You're not ending it, it's getting worse. That was a bit of a rude shock, but this was one of the many things that we learned today. And so I invite you to take that which you have heard today and use it as a mirror in your own life and ask yourself, how can you use this knowledge to your advantage? And I hope that this episode has helped you understand the depth and wisdom of the Bhagavad Gita deeper. Thank you so much for joining us, and goodbye.